The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
To you all, this is Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call, wishing you an excellent weekend ahead and some grist for the mill on the way. Well, it's Friday, September the 30th, and as I'm sure many of you know, it's been clear to me for a long time that what we're experiencing now exceeds by a large margin the severity of the Great Depression of the 1930s. The other day on the show, I made a quick comparison to indicate why this is so. And today, I want to develop that a bit further. When the stock market crashed in October 1929, it was just the beginning of a long period of economic decline and uncertainty that was to last for more than a decade. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit bottom in July 1932, and took 25 years to regain what it had lost in just 34 months. Well, the last 3 years have often been described as the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And while the technical definition of a recession is two successive quarters of GDP decline, it would be hard to convince anyone that the recent GDP growth indicates that the recession is over. Now, there's actually considerable evidence that what we're experiencing is actually worse than the 1930s and should be labeled a depression. So let's have a look at some of the differences. In June 1929, the cumulative national debt was $17 billion. Up until then, the U.S. had only ever gone into debt during times of war. Once those wars ended, the government's first priority was to pay off the debt. When the Depression started, the government was not saddled with servicing a huge debt burden, as the debt was only about 16% of gross national product. Contrast that with the current debt approaching $15,000 billion, which is what you call 15 trillion, but just for comparison's sake, I'm going to use thousands of billions to indicate trillions here. So the current debt is around 15,000 billion with an estimated annual interest cost of over 434 billion for 2011, even with the benefit of extremely low interest rates. Now, understand well that that interest burden is a massive drag on the economy that didn't exist during the Great Depression. As of 2010, the U.S. GNP, or gross national product, was around $15,000 billion as well, leaving the country with a 100% debt-to-GNP ratio. $4,500 billion of the current debt is owned by foreign governments, with almost half held by China and Japan alone. And this gives these countries influence over U.S. foreign policy that may not be overt, but it's there nonetheless. They could also cause financial chaos if they simultaneously sold their treasury holdings. Now, this was not even vaguely an issue in 1929. Beyond the current debt, there are unfunded liabilities for entitlement programs that come due in the future. And these are promises already made without funding to back them up and are not included in the $15,000 billion debt. A USA Today analysis published in June 2011 estimated that these liabilities amount to about $62,000 billion. That's sort of $62 trillion, if you like, or $528,000 per household. This includes an additional $5,300 billion in liabilities added in 2010 alone, primarily for Social Security and Medicare. The difference in total revenues and spending obligations for the year amounted to more than one-third of GDP. The current unfunded liabilities are more than five times the personal debt of the average household, including mortgages, loans, and credit cards. Do you understand enormity of that, ladies and gentlemen? Let me just repeat that. The current unfunded liabilities, that's to say those obligations of the future which have not yet been funded, they are more than five times the personal debt of the average household. That debt will experience exponential growth as the baby boomer generation adds 10,000 retirees per day to the entitlement program rolls. Skyrocketing healthcare costs only add to the problem. These programs resemble a Ponzi scheme in that today's working generation is paying the taxes to fund the payments to those currently collecting benefits. Now, why do I say all this? The answer is because if you can imagine a situation where these programs didn't exist, you're thinking 1929. So there was no burden on the taxpayers to come up with the money to pay for them. All right, let's move on to unemployment. It's actually difficult to compare unemployment statistics because the methodology used to estimate the data has changed over time. At the peak of the Depression in 1933, it's estimated that unemployment reached 25% nationwide. That compares to the 9.1% rate for August 2011, published by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, which identifies the labor pool according to three separate categories. That's to say, those employed, i.e. people with jobs, the unemployed, i.e. people who are jobless, looking for jobs and available for work, and what they call not in the labor force. That's people who are neither employed nor unemployed, which of course is a complete nonsense, and it's all just for political reasons because it has no real meaning in the life that we all know. People who are not in the labor force are people who are unemployed. So that's as simple as that. It doesn't matter who you are. If you're not in the labor force, you're unemployed. If you're retired, fine. That's all very well, but you're still not employed. So you see, the statistics have been completely tweaked and wrenched to provide political expediency and a total lack of transparency. Now remember that people in that last category, they're not in the labor force category, are not counted in the unemployment rate calculation. And if they were, the rate would be 7 to 10% higher. And in addition, the federal deficit of $1,600 billion is paying for about 9 million jobs that wouldn't exist if the budget were balanced. Eliminate those jobs, and the unemployment rate jumps again. Adding in these missing elements brings today's adjusted rate to at least 22 to 25%. Higher than the average 18% rate from 1930 to 1940. On top of that, the savings rate for those with jobs plummeted from about 10% in the 1970s and 80s to 1% in 2007. Well, anybody who thinks consumer spending is going to soar under those conditions are completely delusional. That statistic that I just mentioned portends a bleak future for consumer spending. By the first quarter of 2011, home prices had dropped 33% below the 2006 peak reached in most areas of the U.S. This compares to the 31% drop experienced during the Depression. It took nearly two decades to recover the lost equity. Whether or not housing has reached bottom yet is an open question. Despite historically low interest rates and generous government incentives, government spending is included in GDP, which totaled $14,700 billion for fiscal year 2010. Part of that amount was $1,600 billion of deficit spending, which artificially inflated GDP by 12%. And here's the thing, if you deduct the deficit from total GDP, there has been no GDP growth in the U.S. in the past 4 years. So again, another trick that things are better than they really are. Just yet more ways in which the government lies to you and remains absolutely untouched by the mainstream media. What this means is that the government create the illusion of recovery and prosperity by simply going into more debt. That's what Geithner was trying to do when he was in Europe last week, trying to persuade the Europeans to give the illusion of prosperity by going into more debt and then leveraging up the debt that they took out. And he was just told to go straight home, do not pass go, and do not collect $200, and get the hell out of here. And rightly so. Nobody seems to care. Nobody seems to call the government on this outrage. Anyway, I'm getting off the point here. The debt-to-GDP ratio hasn't been above 100% since World War II. And the country is on the path to exceed that very soon if it doesn't significantly reduce spending. If the unfunded liabilities are added in, the ratio is already a mind-boggling 500%. In 1929, the U.S. dollar was backed by gold. Now it's backed by nothing more than your faith. In 1929, credit cards and home equity loans didn't exist. And people of that era avoided debt like the plague. Today, personal debt levels are near all-time highs. Iconic companies like General Motors and Lehman Brothers survived the Depression without government help or bankruptcy relief. But that didn't happen this time around. In 1929, we didn't face terrorist threats, and we weren't worried about a porous border allowing an influx of millions of illegal aliens. The high price of oil wasn't an issue. Neither was an oppressive regulatory environment. Things like the $40 billion monthly trade imbalance, bloated federal bureaucracy, ballooning state deficits, severely underfunded pensions, crippling tax burden, and crumbling infrastructure just weren't issues then either. It's blindingly obvious that the trillions of dollars borrowed and printed by the government are masking a horrifyingly weak financial condition that has been in a downward spiral for many years. Misnaming it a recession instead of a depression doesn't change the stark reality. And this is one reason why people are feeling too comfortable to take immigrating seriously. There's simply never been a situation in history even remotely comparable to the horror we are facing today. And if you take the trouble to extrapolate any of the factors I've mentioned into the future and follow them to their logical conclusion, I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, you will be on the first plane out tomorrow morning. And if you stay, you're going to see your taxes go up, your savings buying you less, your regulatory burden increase, your opportunities drying up. And all through this nightmare, your freedoms are going to decline. And you better like it too. Make a fuss, and you'll end up on somebody's radar. Well, all right. So let me give you my information quickly. This is Richard Martin. It's the wake-up call, and you are invited to call our toll-free number, which is Gathering Dust, certainly on my show anyway. The number is 888-874-4888. Once more, this is the wake-up call toll-free number at PRN, and it is 888-874-4888. Welcome to use it anytime. If you'd rather write in, please do feel free. Write in to my email, and my email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. Finally, if you would like to use my direct line to call me and discuss any of your private issues, and I have to tell you, I'm getting more and more such calls, and I'm very happy to field them when they come, so do feel free to call me on my direct line at a Sarasota, Florida area code 941-441-1682. Come straight through Singapore at no expense to your good selves after Sarasota. I will be glad to leave your name and phone number if I'm not available, and I will call you back. Once more, the number is 941-441-1682. All right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to just play you a very quick clip. I want you to be very clear about what fiat money is. We've talked about it a lot on the wake-up call, and it's come to me about fiat money, and I feel that it's very important that you understand the difference between what I call real money, that's to say money which is backed by something and usually backed by gold or gold and silver, and what we call fiat money, which is basically money backed by nothing, or your faith, as I talked about just a few moments ago. So I found a clip which I think explains what fiat money is very clearly and very succinctly, and it doesn't last very long, just lasts 3 or 4 minutes. So I'm going to suggest that you sit back and listen to this short clip about fiat money.
Britain took the United States off what was left of the gold standard. The world has operated under a system of money called fiat. The dollar, the pound, the euro are all government fiat currencies. Fiat is a Latin word meaning let it be so. It is the law that this government currency be money. Indeed, without that legal enforcement, and the fact that we must pay taxes in this money, that dollar bill or that computer digit that represents a dollar would be pretty much meaningless. Only the government has the power to issue fiat money, but banks can create it through lending. If somebody wants to borrow $10, a bank can create it from nowhere and lend it. It can then charge interest. Banks also create money by lending against an asset, such as a house. They're given the deeds to the house, and they create the money out of nowhere and lend it, at interest, of course. Over the last 40 years, since this fiat system of money became the global norm, the supply of money has grown exponentially. In fact, we've seen the greatest growth in the supply of money in history. But who benefits? Of course, those that have the power to issue money, governments and banks. They haven't had to do anything productive, they just create money. Then those companies and individuals that get this money early, they can spend it before the prices of the things they want to buy have risen to reflect the new money in circulation. In other words, they get services, products, assets cheap. But prices soon rise, so holders of assets such as shares or houses will then see gains without there necessarily being any improvements to the company or house in question. Often, this can lead to speculative bubbles. gets this money early. However money is created, be it through lending, fractional reserve banking, financial bailouts, or old-fashioned money printing, banks are always at or near the top of the money-issuing pyramid. Next come corporations who borrow large sums, those on lucrative government contracts for new ventures, particularly overseas, banks' associate companies and partners, those that borrow early and at low rates, and the bank's senior employees. They all quickly get their share of the pie. In some cases, this will come in the form of bonuses. But what about those at the bottom of the pyramid? Those on fixed wages or incomes, those who live in remote areas, or those with savings? By the time this newly created money has filtered down to them, the prices of the things they want to buy have increased, their savings buy them less, however, and their wages remain largely unchanged. In some cases, they have to take on debt just to be able to afford the things they were previously able to buy, which means they have to go back to the banks. In reality, this process of creating money only redistributes wealth from the bottom to the top of the pyramid, and thus that ever-increasing gulf between rich and poor gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Okay, well, I think it's a good thing to bring different approaches to this problem of pretend money or fiat money. And so I'll continue to do that because that, after all, money is the basis of what the economy is all about. So I think it's very important for you to understand as intimately as possible the different types of money which control economic systems and have done so throughout the ages. So there you are, that's fiat money for you. Okay, just before we go to break, let me mention, I'm sure you've all heard about the Occupy Wall Street demonstration in Lower Manhattan that seems to be ongoing and picking up some steam. Well, they started out, they were there, as they said, to protest corporate greed in general and in a reflection of the influence of social networking culture to develop one specific major demand after they gathered. As I'm sure you are aware, several thousand people arrived 2 weeks ago, but of course were turned away from Wall Street by a phalanx of NYPD officers manning metal barricades. A few hundred demonstrators, dominated by the scruffy white 20-something college grads known as hipsters, wound up at Zuccotti Park, whose private owners granted them permission to camp there. There they were, and still are, noshing on donated pizza, talking, hanging out, while remaining committed to, quote, absolute nonviolence in the Gandhian tradition, end of quote. Failure, of course, at that time when they started out, was a foregone conclusion. Yet another opportunity to agitate for real change was being wasted by well-meaning idiots. Michael Moore complained about insufficient media coverage, but this non-movement seemed doomed before it began by its refusal to coalesce around a powerful message. It was totally failing to organize and involving the actual victims of Wall Street's perfidy, the people of color, the poor, the evicted, the unemployed, those sick from pollution. And its refusal to argue and appeal on behalf of a beleaguered working class against an arrogant, violent, and unaccountable ruling elite. In other words, to settle for nothing less than the eradication of capitalism. Well, any of you who've been looking at these people and trying to find out what's going on will probably, first of all, be struck by the fact that they really need to lose those clown clothes. You know, this is not the early 1960s. You don't have to wear a suit like the civil rights marchers did. But, you know, if you're going to get national exposure, how about turning up looking like, you know, decent, casual Friday people? You know, revolutionaries are not supposed to expect fair coverage by media outlets owned by the transnational corporations they hope to overthrow. They shouldn't make themselves so easy to mock. Press accounts reveled in Photos of topless women and the dudes on stilts will always show up at these things. So much bad hair, so many colors that don't occur in nature. A protest is a stage. This is, you know, or was turning into a real waste. You know, all over New York City and around the country, people are watching on TV. Now, ideally, you want your viewers to drop what they're doing and come and join you. At a bare minimum, you want them to approve, to identify with you, maybe even send a check. You know, they say they represent 99% of Americans getting screwed by the top 1%. So why don't they act like the 99%, dress like them, be normal, be inclusive and welcoming? You know, there were some reporters there, and they quoted demonstrators who sounded as ignorant about current affairs as members of the Tea Party. Perhaps a little bit nicer. It was a perfect setup for hit pieces by the likes of Ginia Belafonte, who called the downtown gathering, quote, an opportunity to air societal grievances as carnival, and slammed the group's lack of cohesion and its apparent wish to pantomime progressivism rather than practice it knowledgeably. End of quote. You know, history has proven that an absolute commitment to nonviolence can never effect radical change. And this was shown again on Saturday, September the 23rd, when police used orange plastic nets to kettle, as they say, and arrest about 80 Occupy Wall Streeters who had been marching peacefully through Greenwich Village. And according to numerous witnesses and media accounts, none resisted. Well, the cops went wild, beating several men and macing at least one woman after she'd been cuffed. You know, sadly, too many people angry at gangster capitalists will look at the YouTube videos of bloodied young faces and say to themselves, I'm willing to suffer for a cause, not a scene. You know, this is just the problem in America. A kind of frivolous apathy seems to infect society, a kind of arrogant feeling that they're above the rest of the world and they don't really have to care that much, so let's just go to some of these demonstrations and enjoy ourselves and dress up a little bit. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you the terrible truth is that people are not hurting badly enough yet. But you see, that's just my point. Things will get monstrously worse, and by the time people are really in a mood to demand change, the forces of law and order will just stamp them out before they begin. And as I've said over and over again, you know, it's going to get very bloody in the years to come. But then, and it's just like my earlier predictions, nobody could prove that the housing market was going to collapse, and consequently almost nobody sold their houses in time. But it wasn't for lack of warning here on the wake-up call. There's a vast and growing apparatus of intimidation designed to deter and control citizen protests. And it seems that the most that's allowed is to assemble with the permission of state authorities and remain roped off in sequestered, out-of-the-way areas, the Orwellian-named free speech zones. And anything that is even remotely disruptive or threatening is going to be met with aggressive force. Pepper spray, mass arrests by highly militarized urban police forces, and aggressive prosecutions. Recall the wild excesses of force in connection with the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. The overzealous prosecutions of civil disobedience activists like Eric Swartz, environmentalists Tim DeChristopher and Dan Choi, the war being waged on whistleblowers for the crime of exposing high-level wrongdoing, the treatment of these Wall Street protesters. Financial elites and their political servants are well aware that exploding wealth inequality, pervasive economic anxiety, and increasing hostility towards institutions of authority, and corresponding realization that voting fixes very little of this, are likely to bring London-style unrest and worse to American soil. It was just 2 weeks ago that New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg warned that the unemployment crisis could trigger what he called riots. Even the complacent American citizenry, well-trained in learning impotence and acquiescence to those most responsible for their plight, is going to reach a tipping point of unrest. There are numerous weapons of surveillance and coercion that have been developed over the last decade in anticipation of that unrest. Most of it justified in the name of terrorism, but all of it featuring decidedly dual-use domestic capability. And you can see how this has been extensively used in the Patriot Act, in non-terrorist cases, and how rarely it has been used for terrorism. In fact, I just saw a statistic today which told me that there are over 1,600 cases of how the Patriot Act, which was specifically designed for terrorism, has been used for drug offenses, and just 11 cases in the pursuit of terrorism. There's a sprawling apparatus of federal and local militarized police forces and private corporate security channels designed to send this message. You know, if you participate in protests or other forms of dissent outside harmless approved channels, you're going to be harmed in numerous ways. And as Eve Smith put it this week, Eve Smith being a very prescient economic blogger that I follow on a daily basis, and she said as follows, "I'm beginning to wonder whether the right to assemble is effectively dead in the United States. No one who is a wage slave, which is the overwhelming majority of the population, can afford to have an arrest record, even a misdemeanor, in this age of short job tenures and rising use of background checks. This is all designed to deter any meaningful challenges to the government and corporate institutions which are suffocating them, to bully those who consider such challenges into accepting its futility." And guess what? It works. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let us take a break, and as always, I'll be right back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, a few emails. First of all, I got a very nice email from Johnny Müller, who is the host of a PRN program each week called The Expat Files, Living in America. And he took the trouble to write to me, and so I thought I would let you have the information that he gives me here on the show right now. He said, "It's me, Johnny Müller, your fellow PRN host from the Expat Files Living in Latin America. You have an extraordinarily great show. I'm an Austrian school guy from way back. In fact, I listen to you, Gary, and Steve Lendman, who has the time for more. As do you, I always recommend living out of the U.S. too, specifically Latin America. I notice a lot of your listener call-ins and emails ask about moving to specific Latin countries, and folks ask about specific places and details, which of course you can provide firsthand in places like Argentina and Panama, where you have been and lived. But you'd be doing them a favor when questions about specific Latin countries come up by adding your bit, of course, but then simply referring them to my show Tuesday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and, of course, the PRN archives. All over Latin America is where I've lived for 20 years. I know the place intimately. In fact, I've had more than a dozen businesses bought, sold, and developed. I've made and lost a lot of money, too. I've sued people and been sued, been robbed at gunpoint more than once, been through many earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, and landslides. I've even been shot at 3 or 4 times. And for over 4 years, I was the highest paid Latin American radio host. As you know, highly paid in L.A., which I think means Latin American as opposed to Los Angeles. Highly paid in L.A. terms is peanuts compared with the first world, but eminently livable down here. Latin America is all I talk about. I love it, despite all of the things I sometimes say, and I will never leave. But the fact is, I know certain angles expat wannabes really need to understand, and I go into them in a great deal. When new expats come down, they don't have to reinvent the wheel, but often do and get very frustrated. I've done that many times myself, and know most of the Latin pitfalls, though I do still fall into them occasionally. On my show, I don't give the international living, Agora version, that's always trying to hype or sell you a great near first world clone of some golf course, condo or housing development. I tell it like it really is, and I'm not selling anything. Anyway, great work, and thanks for giving me a general plug. I heard that you do that a few weeks ago. Johnny Miller, the expat files living in Latin America. Well, I have mentioned Johnny's program from time to time on the wake-up call, and so I have no compunction in giving it a really good plug at this point, because many people are sort of coming to me and telling me that, you know, living too far away from the United States is not an option because of family considerations and other things. Canada being, of course, the obvious choice for those who don't want to speak another language. But my experience in Latin America tells me that, in principle, the real important thing to understand about Latin America is that these countries are already poor, and you really can't get much poorer than poor. So you're not going to see the same wrenching decline in any of these countries that you will see in the United States. And it also, Latin America for me has the added advantage that the people, because they're poor, have a great sense of cohesion and helping and being in a socially welcoming environment for just about anybody who goes there. And I think it wouldn't really matter if you turned up with just the clothes on your back or whether you turned up in a Rolls Royce. They really do have a natural sense of empathy towards everybody in those countries. Very hard to describe and hard to imagine in a country like America, where, you know, people put their old people in homes as soon as they can and never see their relatives from, you know, 1 year to the next. A much different environment, and quite frankly, if you're going to have to be poor, it's much, much more pleasurable to be poor in a place where people are naturally friendly and welcoming than in a place where people are sterile and cold and heartless and basically, frankly, I think I'm describing the United States. But it's up to you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting a lot of calls these days about emigrating. I strongly recommend that you listen in to Johnny's program, The Expat Files, and I'm trying to remember where he puts where he Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So there you are. I'm sure you're able to ask questions on that show as well. I know he lives in El Salvador, so give it your best. Okay, so let's have a look at somebody else who might have written in. Anne wrote in, "Hi, Richard. Well, this is a new one. I'm paying off credit cards. I pay the total amount due before the due date, and then I see that I still owed an interest. The bank says that is the interest that accrued between the statement date and the time I paid. If I hadn't noticed this extra charge, they would have charged me a late fee. Could owe as little as $1.77. This has happened with three different accounts. I thought that it was paid in full. No. When I call, they seem almost too eager to take the charge off. Really, do not understand it. Do you know anything about this? Might be worth warning your listeners about, don't you? Sincerely, Anne." Well, Anne, I've done what I can. I've warned the listeners. I'm not familiar with this. It's never actually happened to me, but I'm sure there are plenty of people for whom it has happened. And the moral of the story is check those bills with a fine tooth comb and don't pay anything that you don't think you deserve to pay. And if you call the 800 number, the chances are very high that they will take off the charges. And this has happened to me a couple of times in Singapore since I've been here, for bona fide reasons, not at all reasons for which they are trying to throw in extra charges. But as a general rule, they do reverse these charges. They are reversible. They're not written in stone. So you know, do what you can. Okay, so here we have another email. Thor Dockweiler from Los Angeles, California, writes in saying, "Dear Richard, as an avid listener to your archive, thank you for letting us, the listeners, know about Anne McKitten's email suggestion on the excellent Al Jazeera series Meltdown. Two parts in under 2 hours have been shown so far. Chilling to our souls. Some nice, honest reporting for once. U.S. news has sucked for years. Amazing that I have to get my news from outside my own abode. The U.S. big banks intentionally planned this international theft, just as they did in 1929. I look forward to the whole four-part sub-movie series, Meltdown, The Secret History of the Global Financial Collapse, Part 1. The Men Who Crashed the World, Part 2, A Global Financial Tsunami, Part 3, Paying the Price, Part 4. Okay, Shaw would like to order this as a DVD. Keep up your excellent work, Thor Dockweiler, Los Angeles, California. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I did recommend this last week or Monday, I can't remember when, and again, it's put into the Al Jazeera website, that's A-L-J-A-Z-E-E-R-A, that's Al Jazeera, and then it put go to their website and then put into the box Meltdown, or if you want to put it in the first part, you can write in The Secret History of the Global Financial Collapse. And as Thor said, there are four parts, and two of them have already come out, so you can view those, and the other two I'm sure will be out very soon. Okay. So, I'm thinking that I would like to talk about somebody that I have been following, one of my gurus, somebody that I learned more about economics from than anybody else, whose name is Kurt Riechebecher. He died tragically in 2007, but we don't have that much time left, so I am not going to do that. I'm going to save that for Monday. And in the meantime, I just got an email from Lou, who says that the third meeting of the Richard Martin wake-up call is to be October the 30th at 2 p.m. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've got plenty of time. You've got exactly 1 month to prepare for the next meeting of the the meetup group, my meetup group. As a matter of fact, I didn't know that Johnny Miller lived in El Salvador, and I actually invited him to talk and to give a presentation on the group, but I'm afraid that El Salvador is rather a long way to come to New Brunswick, New Jersey. So anyway, we will hope to have some interesting things for you on that date. That's, make a note, the 30th of October. At 2 p.m., the location to be announced. So we'll see what gives between now and then. Okay, so, as I say, I think I will let you wait for my information about Kurt Riechebecher, who, as I say, he died very tragically. He was old, but there was nobody like him in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I miss him even today. He was really a beacon in the dark. But anyway, let's check in for a moment, and let me make sure that you really do understand the real problem that we face today, ladies and gentlemen. And it's not a lack of stimulus. And whatever these people like Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner may say, the idea of pouring money into a black hole, which is what they're trying to persuade the Europeans to do, and I think the Europeans will not do, but this whole concept of stimulus, of the glorification of money as the answer to all problems, is just so misguided, it's painful. This has nothing to do with the problem. And by the way, the idea that there is an inequality of income distribution and that the rich, the top 1% own 50%, it's true and it's unconscionable. I absolutely get it and I totally agree, but it is not a part of the problem. And it's very cruel of people to try to conflate the terrible economic environment in which we live today with the inequality of wealth in the United States and elsewhere. It really, unfortunately, has nothing to do with it. If it was that simple, then we could press for change and hope that something would come. But that isn't the problem. And here's something else which isn't the problem. The fact that the feds didn't regulate enough. The truth is, they didn't regulate when they should have. They didn't keep the mortgage market under tabs and in control. That's when Alan Greenspan should have done his job. He didn't. So now it's too late. Greedy bankers is something also which meets the headlines every day, but it's not the real problem. And it's important to know this. It's important to understand that it is a moral problem and it is contemptible. Yes, the bankers picking up bonuses for money which has been lent to them by the taxpayer through the Federal Reserve. That is unconscionable. Of course it is. But it isn't the real problem. Even the idea that capitalism does or doesn't work, that's not the problem. It's always being thrown up as a sort of smokescreen that if only we could change capitalism, everybody would be better off. That really isn't the issue. Here is the problem, ladies and gentlemen. The problem is debt. There's too much of it. And there's too much of it because the feds encouraged people to borrow and spend too much. And that's what a pure paper dollar system does. And that's why I hope you understood that clip that I played earlier on in the show. I hope you really understood. If you didn't get it, listen to it again. It's very good. It describes the concept of pure paper money very well. And it's what made it possible for the U.S. to spend. You see, the money that the U.S. has put out inevitably goes overseas. But instead of returning that money to the Treasury and exchanging it for gold, which is what ought to happen, the foreigners just keep the money overseas. It's used as bank reserves. And of course, in effect, this means that Americans never have to settle up. The debt just builds and builds and builds. And as I'm sure you've been told, not just by me, but many times, you are aware that the U.S. trade deficits accumulated since 1971 total to some $8 trillion. And that's the difference between what Americans have spent overseas and what they've sold to foreigners. And it's still growing by about $50 billion a month. Now, much of this money does eventually come back to the U.S. But of course, it comes back as debt. The foreigners lend it back to the U.S. government. What use is that? You see, without the fiat money, there wouldn't be any money to be lent back, and the debt situation, the national debt situation, couldn't grow. But the fact that we get this money back in the form of debt enables the U.S. government debt to grow at about $100 billion a month. And obviously too much debt causes problems. It turns malignant. There's no way that economies can recover until the debt is reckoned with. But reckoning with debt is painful. And the bankers who hold much of the bad debt and the politicians who often work for the bankers, they don't want to suffer pain. They want someone else to suffer it, preferably someone in the future, someone who's not yet of voting age. But you see, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't work. As the economy slows under the weight of debt, the pain spreads. And 2 weeks ago, Obama announced this $447 billion jobs program, and the Dow Jones went down 300 points. And that's all we know, and it's all we need to know. Investors no longer believe that stimulus measures will produce the long-awaited recovery. Oh yes, stocks are headed down. Bernanke has pledged to keep lending at negative interest rates for the next 2 years. And now Obama has come up with nearly a half trillion in new spending, making nonsense of the recent debt ceiling discussions. They've fired both barrels, in other words, fiscal and monetary. And the Great Correction didn't flinch. Why? Because the Obama plan adds debt, the very thing the economy needs least of all. Well, economic turmoil in the U.S. and in Europe is helping to accelerate a deeper long-term development. After three centuries of economic dominance, the West is about to be eclipsed by China. Not only may the Chinese economy soon be larger than America's, if measured in purchasing power, but the renminbi could displace the dollar as the premier reserve currency within the next decade or soon thereafter. Well, skeptics will scoff for two reasons. First, even if China's economy does overtake America's, the renminbi's rise could be delayed. America's economy surpassed Great Britain's in the early 1870s, but the dollar displaced sterling decisively only around World War II. That implies there could be a lag of about 70 years between economic dominance and currency ascendancy. Secondly, China is far from creating the policy and market environment for the renminbi to become a reserve currency. China's capital account is still largely closed, and the renminbi is still not convertible and freely available to foreigners. Its financial system is government-controlled, and its markets lack the depth to provide the liquidity critical to make a currency attractive to hold and trade. In these circumstances, how could foreign governments or private players make payments in renminbi and hold renminbi assets or denominate economic transactions in renminbi? In other words, loyalty to the dollar and China's lack of the policy prerequisites seem to make the renminbi's rise a distant possibility. How wrong that is. First, the usual historical analogy is misleading. Ceded its economic dominance much later, and sterling its dominance much earlier than is believed. Economic dominance, in the sense of the factors that determine reserve currency status, is affected not just by the size of an economy, but its trade and external financial strength. On this metric, the U.S. overtook the U.K. not in the 1870s, but only around World War I. In fact, the U.K. was the world's largest exporter and net financier until the 1920s. And secondly, China has all but caught up with the U.S. as an economic power. Its economy is about as large in purchasing power, while the exports and overseas assets are much larger. If one were to draw the correct historical analogy, then the potential eclipse of the dollar is just a decade away. Chinese economic strength creates the conditions for the rise of its currency. Well, the income of the typical American family has dropped for the third year in a row and is roughly now where it was in 1996 when adjusted for inflation. The income of a household considered to be at the statistical middle fell 2.3% to an inflation-adjusted $49,445 in 2010, which is 7.1% below its 1999 peak, according to the Census Bureau. The nation's poverty rate spiked to 15.1% in 2010, the highest level since 1993, again according to the Census Bureau, reported on Tuesday. About 46.2 million Americans lived in poverty last year, marking an increase of 2.6 million over 2009, and the fourth consecutive annual increase in poverty, and that is the largest increase that we have ever seen since the government began calculating poverty figures back in 1959. Median household income has also fallen again, which makes 3 years in a row. According to the Census Bureau, median household income dropped 2.3% in 2010 after accounting for inflation. Overall, median household income has declined by a total of 6.8% once you account for inflation since December 2007. It's important to keep in mind that the government definition of poverty rises based on the rates of inflation. If inflation was still calculated the way it was 30 or 40 years ago, the poverty line would be much, much higher, and millions more Americans would be considered to be living in poverty. Unemployment is rampant, and the number of good jobs continues to shrink. There are fewer payroll jobs in the U.S. today than there were in 2000, even though 30 million people have been added to the population since then. Back in 1969, 95% of all men between the ages of 25 and 54 had a job. In July of this year, only 81.2% of men in that age group had a job. Did you know that if you gathered together all of the unemployment people in the United States, they would constitute the 68th largest country in the world? According to John Williams of shadowstats.com, if you factored in all of the short-term discouraged workers, all of the long-term discouraged workers, and all of those working part-time because they cannot find full employment, the real unemployment rate right now would be approximately 23%. If you have been unemployed for at least 1 year, there is a 91% chance that you will not find a new job within the next month. The number of Americans that are going to food pantries and soup kitchens has increased by 46% since 2006. Very, very sobering indeed, ladies and gentlemen. Very grim, and it's going to get a lot worse. Well, with that, I wish you a wonderful weekend ahead. I hope all of you will get what you wish for, and as opposed to what you sometimes deserve, frankly, those of you who have not perhaps led your finances in the strictest discipline that you might have. But all in all, I hope for the best for all of you. And this is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till Monday.